Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. It's really a treat and an honor to be here this afternoon, and to Terry and Jerry and to all of you who came out, I really want to thank you. I'm here in Silicon Valley right now working on a book. I'm on sabbatical from my column. I've been for the last few months. I come back in October just in time for the last month of the election. And what I'm going to do today is really try to give you two talks that I hope will come together in one talk. Or give one overriding impression. The first will be to try to walk you through my own tortured thinking on Iraq, and then to share with you a little bit about the new book I'm working on. Let me start by saying I always consider myself very lucky to be the foreign affairs columnist for the New York Times. I have the best job in the world. I mean, somebody has to have it. I've got it, and you don't. No, I get to be a tourist with an attitude. I get to go all over the world and wherever I want, whenever I want, and have whatever attitudes I want. There's only one downside with my job, and it's that I have to have attitudes twice a week, every Thursday and every Sunday. And in the time I've been a foreign affairs columnist, I can honestly say that there's no issue that I've had to wrestle with that has been, for me, more personally agonizing and vexing than the whole post 9/11 era and the whole debate around the Iraq War. For those of you who have followed my column, you know that I came down in support of the war, 52 to 49. I always say I supported the war 52 to 49 because I was keenly aware that there was something irrational in my decision, in my agonizing decision to tilt that way, and it really ultimately was a tilt. I knew that the situation in Iraq was so much more complicated than the administration ever presented it. At the same time, I also knew that the stakes in trying to partner with people in that part of the world to tilt a region that was deeply tilted in the wrong direction, in a different direction, was also hugely important. I heard many voices as I sort of agonized over what positions to take in the war. One was my own voice. Tom, you lived in Beirut for 5 years. Iraq is just Beirut on steroids. How could you possibly ever think we could tilt that country in a different direction? I heard the voices of heard the voice quite often of my own wife, who was with me in Beirut. When I wrote that I had a mixed marriage, that my wife tilted against the war and I tilted in favor of it, I was inundated by email from people who told me that my wife was smarter than I was. Please listen to your wife, and it's good to know you sleep with a woman more intelligent than you are. But ultimately, what tilted me, and I'm going to give you as honest an analysis as I possibly can this afternoon, because I think this is such an important issue, and I approached it, rightly or wrongly, in a totally apolitical fashion. I'm a liberal weenie. No secret who I voted for in every election and who I will be voting for in the next election. So for me to come down where I came down was an agonizing decision for me. But I want to take you through it because I think this is such an important decision that whether you agree with me or agree with it, that we think about it seriously. And without further ado, let me jump into that analysis. I begin my analysis of Iraq with 9/11, not for the reasons Dick Cheney or George Bush do. I never believed Saddam had any weapons of mass destruction that threatened us. I wrote that consistently before the war and consistently after the war. For me, that was really not the issue. I do believe, though, that what 9/11 was about, that what Al-Qaeda and the Islamist terrorists really represent, is the third great totalitarian challenge to open societies. The first great totalitarian challenge to open societies, in my view, was that posed by Nazi Germany in the form of the Nazi threat, and the attempt to use the engine of Nazi Germany to impose the reign of the perfect race, the Aryan race. The second great totalitarian challenge to open societies was that posed by Marxist-Leninism, which attempted to use the engine of the Soviet Union to impose the reign of the perfect class, the ruling class. I believe what Al-Qaeda represents, what the Islamist terrorists represent, is the third great totalitarian challenge, which is an attempt to use the engines of globalization to impose the reign of what they see as the perfect faith, political Islam. Now, you are entitled to say, as I've often said to myself, Friedman, get a grip on. How could you possibly compare Osama bin Laden and his ragtag band of men in caves in Afghanistan with the Soviet Red Army? 50,000 tanks and 50,000 nuclear weapons? How could you possibly compare those two? Well, not only would I compare them, I would tell you that the threat of embodied by bin Ladenism is a greater threat to the open society, ultimately, than anything the Soviet Union ever posed to us. You see, the Soviet Union was deterrable with 50,000 nukes and 50,000 tanks of our own. And the reason the Soviet Union was deterrable was because, ultimately, we shared certain bedrock values with the Soviets at the end of the day. At the end of the day, the Soviet Union loved life more than it hated us, its leaders, its generals, and certainly its people. That's why the Cuban Missile Crisis ended the way it did. At the end of the day, they love life more than they hate us. We are up against an enemy in Al-Qaeda who boasts of the fact that they hate us more than they love life. Well, that in itself makes them, to some degree, undeterrable. But what makes them such an important and dangerous threat to open societies is that when you have people who are ready to commit suicide using instruments from our daily life, the telephone, the cell phone, the car, the automobile, the tennis shoe, when people take instruments from our daily life and turn them into weapons, what they do is attack the very essential thing that keeps an open society open. And that is trust. Without trust, there's no open society. You trusted when I came into this room, to take an absurd example, that I wasn't wearing a bomb-laden vest. I trusted when I parked my car outside that the car next to it wouldn't blow up. I trusted when I flew out here on United Airlines that the woman sitting next to me wasn't wearing exploding tennis shoes. Without trust, there is no open society because there are not enough police to police every opening in an open society. And the enemy we are up against is deliberately attacking the very thing that keeps an open society open. And that is trust. And that's why the threat that they pose is a very real threat. So what do we do about it? How do we think about how to come to terms with this? Now, my own thinking was shaped the morning after 9/11. I happened to be in Israel on September 11th, 2001. I was there covering the Intifada by accident. And the morning after, At the time, I knew the chief of military intelligence in Israel. I called him late that night after the events in New York and said, I really would love to come in and talk to you about what you guys have learned from your own experience with suicide terrorism that might be helpful for me in understanding what we've now encountered in the United States. So the next morning, in the morning of September 12, 2001, I met with a group of Israeli terrorism experts. And I asked them what they'd learned in dealing with the suicide bombings. And they taught me something that morning that has guided my thinking ever since. They said, look, at the end of the day, Tom, we can get lucky. We can catch a suicide bomber here. We can have good intelligence. We can, you know, nip another one there. But at the end of the day, the only people who can stop Palestinian suicide bombing are Palestinians. Only they can delegitimize it, and only they can stop it. And I am a huge believer in that, that at the end of the day, there's only one deterrent to this phenomena, and it is what a culture, what a society deems as shameful. I believe culture, that it takes a village, and that culture and what a society, a religious group deems as shameful is the ultimate and most important restraint in human behavior.